Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Terence Clark, a former ambassador to Iraq in Saddam's time, sometimes also known as Abu Naji or even Mukhtar Dakasob, which for the non-Arabists means the boss across the river, which was the name given to Percy Cox at one stage when he was still managing the Iraqi government. This first session after lunch is often regarded as the, shall we say, slightly somnolent session, but I am promised by the first speaker, Dr. Wolfgang Köhler, that he will provide a little spice. So that is something to look forward to further enliven what has already been a lively discussion this morning. Dr. Köhler's bio details are on the paper in front of you, but he was a well-known journalist for the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung and also an academic. Our second speaker is on my right, your left, Miriam Yaqubi. I assumed when I saw her name must be from the Iraqi diaspora, but she assures me that she is of Tunisian-French origin, born and raised in France. She, perhaps because of her French connections, is going to bring out some of the romanticism of Gertrude Bell and her view of King Faisal and the Arabs in general. Our third speaker is also well known to you already from his earlier address, Dr. Saad Iskander. Perhaps it is less well known to you that he is from one of the minorities of Iraq, from the Fa'ili, that is Shia Kurds, although he regards himself as Baghdadi. He's already well known for his work in the field of assembling historical information about Iraq in general, but his theme this afternoon is perhaps less well known about the role that Gertrude Bell played in the with the Kurds in what is now regarded as Kurdistan or southern Kurdistan. I'll call first on Dr. Köhler to make his presentation.
Thank you very much, Sir Terence, for your kind words of introduction. I hope I will not disappoint you or anybody, and let's see.
I'll try to manage this technology. Am I connected with the microphone?
Yes.
The title of my presentation, "We Have Put Our King on the Throne," is a quotation from Bell's letter of the 28th of August 1921 to her father, on the enthronement of Faisal as king of Iraq 5 days earlier. And this act marked the highlight and the turning point of her life in Mesopotamia, which was to become Iraq. It therefore deserves special attention. When speaking of or writing about Bell's political activities in that country, in its style, the letter hardly differs from many of her other letters she wrote from Iraq, most of them addressed to her father and her stepmother, who edited many of them in the shortened and censored form in the next year after her death. Like many of her other letters, that one could be described as a cocktail of political information and assessment mixed with stories about her social life and personal observations. Some of them marked secret, and last not least, weather reports. The same limitations apply to Elizabeth Bourgoin's edition of 1961, I think. The text of these letters made available by the Newcastle archives are longer than the others I mentioned. Whether they are complete or not, I can't say. Apparently, this collection does not include all letters of historical significance which Bell has addressed to different people and are kept in different locations. In my presentation, I mainly rely on Bell's published letters, which for me are more authentic than her other writings, such as her books and articles and her reports to her superiors in the government. I am inclined to agree with Thomas Edward Lawrence, who wrote in to Bell's father after her death, "Her letters are exactly herself." Or may I say, closer to herself than her other writings, perhaps apart from her diaries. Whether she was very happy in her death, for her political work was finished, as mine, as Lawrence claims, and that the Iraqi state was a fine monument, even if it only lasted a few more years, these comments are very disputable at best. Well, again, we had a terrific week, but we have got our king crowned. This is the key sentence in the first paragraph of her letter, and it says it all. Bell does not show any restraint, no understatement, no doubt. Nothing could be called a diplomatic formula. It's our king. And that meant the official representative of Britain's, including herself, and had done what the government wanted them to do. Yet it was not a coronation in the literal sense, but rather an enthronement, as she herself wrote in the next paragraph. Bell refers to her previous letter of 21st of August and marks the sentence as secret, the impossible problem that His Majesty government had presented to us at the last moment. In his so-called coronation speech, Faisal must announce, quoting the demand from London, must announce that the ultimate authority in the land is the High Commissioner. Faisal refused, and he is right, as Bell said, we are going to drop the mandate and enter into treaty relations with Mesopotamia. And so on. I suppose I have to skip stretches of time. The government in London finally agreed and withdrew this sentence. And so the enthronement got away. And quoting Bell, she did not withhold her criticism of the people in charge within her own government, whom she, in the next paragraph of her letter of 21st of August, accused of ignorance. And I quote, "They don't understand. Perhaps it can't be expected that we are not building here with lifeless stones. We are encouraging the living thing to grow, and we feel it pulsing in our hands. We can direct it to a great extent, but we can't prevent it growing upwards. That is indeed what we have invited it to do." In her letter, 28th of August, she provides a report of the enthronement, which is framed by reports of dinner parties, which together with reports of other social activities take a lot of space in many of her letters. She describes the enthronement admirably managed. 1,500 people invited, admitted by tickets. The air police did not allow anybody in after the function had begun and tried to get technology. I'm on board.
passes technology. That's not what I was going to say. The next. Now you have seen almost all. I'm sorry. It did not work. I found pictures of bad technical quality of the enthronement. One picture shown the people who attended it, and the other one, what they call the dais with the throne where Faisal was sitting. But obviously, I did not succeed. So let me see, where are we? Yes, at one point, yeah, admirably managed this meant she was paying a compliment to herself because she was one of the persons who arranged or managed the installment. The king was in uniform, which meant he was wearing the khaki, as Gerald de Sori, Dittagori, tells us. Cox dressed in white diplomatic uniform. I don't know whether it's
yes,
white uniform.
Wonderful. Only in monarchies.
So, but Faisal, she wrote, looked very dignified, but much strung up. It was an agitating moment. Apparently he felt a bit insecure of himself in this unfamiliar environment and needed some assurance. And she writes, he looked along the front row and caught my eye, and I gave him a tiny salute. One of the pictures, I can't show you, she was supposed to sit in the first row, and you could have got an idea anyway. Then Sayyid Hussein Afnan, Faisal's secretary, read a proclamation on behalf of the High Commissioner in which he announced that Faisal had been elected king by 96%, I repeat, 96% of the people of Mesopotamia. Long live the king! The assembly stood up and saluted the king. The national flag was broken on a flagstaff by his side, and the band played God Save the King, since the new state had no national anthem yet. It was given a religious element included in the state ceremony when chewing the salute of 21 gun, very inappropriately, the prayer of thanksgiving to God was read, ending by doing homage to Faisal on behalf of the Council of Ministers. Had he been sent by God, one might wonder, like the monarchs in Europe in the Middle Ages. Then apparently got carried away. Her emotions can be sensed in the letter she wrote 5 days later. It was, as she said, an amazing thing to see all Iraq from north to south gathered together. It happened, so she claimed, for the first time in history. After the ceremony, Bell had breakfast with the Coxes and later that day a dinner of 8 in her house, as she recorded. Next morning, Faisal had what was called a levee. Not less revealing about the political realities of the newly established state. To everybody present, it was obvious who was running the show and calling the shots. It was visible. No declaration, no explanation was needed. I have to look at the light. In her letter of the same letter to the 28th of August, it furthermore becomes obvious that Bell, Duppets, formerly Oriental Secretary of the High Commission and informally advisor and confidant of the king, a position she used to influence the king
policy of his government. Neither to her nor to her superiors was there a conflict of interest and loyalty, which certainly was whispered first, and nobody seemed to see a contradiction between the two tasks or a problem of identity, which was certainly British. Well fulfilled both jobs, quote unquote, openly to call her Avinash Kreese would be inappropriate. Criticism of being too pro-Arab, which came up at home apparently, did not do any harm to her. The next day, Bell slips into her role as advisor to the king. He had asked her for tea, and they spent 2 hours together. The conversation was a mixture, could be called a mixture of personal exchanges and discussions of political matters. She spent what she calls in her letter the happy hour with Kaiser, discussing different things such as our desert frontier with south and west, and the national flag and Faisal's personal flags. However, not everybody present at the installment would agree with Bell's excitement. One of them, a political officer called Wallace Lyon, witnessed the installment, and his memoirs were published many years later. And to continue. Lyon used the word coronation, which was arranged to follow swiftly on the elections, the so-called elections, but corrects himself for using the wrong word, for among the Arabs, there is no such thing as a crown. Unfortunately, on this picture, which I cannot show, he wears something which is certainly not a crown, but it looks like this helmet which was worn during the First World War by the British and by the Germans. I don't know the word, but whatever is allowing, perhaps you know how it is called. What he? Sorry. Yeah. Whatever that means. Yes. Something like that. Lyon is the supporters of the new king, Cornwallis, Joyce, and the ex-Turkish officers of Iraqi origin and Arab blood, who had been captured by us, British, during the war, and who had elected to support Sharif's rebellion under Faisal. Lyon's observation of what happened immediately after the ceremony exposes some certainly unintended farcical aspects. A working party dismantled the platform and the throne, which, according to Lyon, stripped of its regalia, was seen to have been hurriedly put together from sections of Japanese beer crates with the sensil mark Asahi and Navi still showing on the seat. The view of this provided the junior British officer a hilarious anti-climax to the solemnity of the occasion, though as an omen it could hardly be interpreted to predict solidity for the foundation of the Hashemite rule, nor its adherence to the orthodox Muslim attitude towards alcohol. But junior army officers were not in the councils of the great and consequently did not concern themselves with political prognostications. They did not know that the election was rigged. Still less could they foresee that every subsequent election would be rigged until the final collapse of the counterfeit democracy with the violent death of the Hashemite family and all its principles Congress in 1958. Oh, 5 minutes. Well, I can't have. I have interesting stuff which I might include in the printed version. Background qualification. This. No. Sorry. I try my best. Ah, yeah. Who was Gert Rosenbell? Here we see how in this hub in the garden of the British Embassy, late 19th century, she was invited by a relative of her stepmother, and she is reading a book, and we can only speculate, is it Hafez she was going to translate, or is it really nice? And in the background you see a young man who perhaps is this young diplomat who would ask her to marry her, but her father objected, and so this did not work. It has a significance for her further career, because if she had married him and had established a family, I don't think she would have traveled as she did, and certainly not this trip in 1914 to Heil. So as one historian told me, her father destroyed her life. I can't say, but I mean, this becomes important to show. This was her first visit to the Middle East, and this was to follow by many other visits, but I can't go into details. What was her qualification? She came from a rich family, and we can put it in short, can say she was the daughter of Danton Abbey, who got astray and lost her way in the desert. In short, my time is short. We all have watches, but we are looking forward to watch the next part of Danton Abbey, and I think she could put in this context, and we are looking forward for two future films, one with Naomi Watts, who can now be seen as Diana, and then she is supposed, reportedly, will move from her role as Diana to get rid of Bell. And one theater play by Kleining is reportedly in preparation to be shown, or perhaps it has been performed already in New York, and what else? And I don't know how many biographies have been written. So, what I say, she could have never dreamt of a career she actually had when she was shown in the garden of the British Embassy in Tehran in 1892. And her future life, I'm afraid to say, and perhaps you will correct me, there was not much romance. Oh, no, let me just mention one fantastic thing, her informal activities, which are reported extensively in this wonderful essay by James Morris, who became Jane Morris. The Anglo-Arabs. Well, I can't go into details. It's the most delightful reading, and I can't give you even a summary. I tried to put it in one or two sentences. Basically, she turned the Faisal and the royal court into what she called pastiche of Westerns, British in particular. And she is, and also, this also is expressed in letters by Gertrude Bell and other authors. And I'm looking forward, Mr. Alawi, what he has to say in his biography. But these people, for my mind, they looked somehow funny, imitating a British way of life, and there was a tailor in Baghdad, and so on and so forth. But all this will be in my printed version, and I only can recommend. Let me go hastily through the next, if I succeed. There is one biography which
who gives us an idea. Again, I don't see any need to repeat the pictures, the photos which we have seen before. These cartoons, I would call it illustrations from an early biography, are very revealing. They show this romantic view she created in the West, like Faisal. Faisal was the romantic prince from the desert in the British mind, and he was also the westernized Arab, what was called Wok, Wiley, Oriental gentleman. And here we see another picture, and here a nice cartoon, if you like. I cannot, time is so short, and here we see the cover of a book, Vincent Foley. I mean, he was instrumental at the conference in Cairo in March 21 under the influence of Lawrence, and this again influenced Gatwood as well. Here it is. This is the picture I was looking for. This shows Faisal sitting on the throne.
Stealing the romanticism from Miriam Yarbouri.
I hope. This is the other side. This is the audience. Yeah, and this is a portrait for the National Gallery. And here, this is also revealing. I'm not suggesting you should read this biography. It's not worthwhile. But it shows the romantic perception. Desert Queen, and we have the pyramids with the Sphinx, and we have people on camels, including Gertrude de Bell and Churchill. And here we have Princess Moment. I can't quote the time is too short. I'm sorry. Time's off. And here, it's not an advertisement, Toby and Sally. I think it's worthwhile reading. But when you look in the first sight, it looked, nothing has actually changed from this man, from the one man to the other. I'm sorry, this haste, but it's too much.
To thank the organizing committee of this conference, as well as all the institutions participating in it, for giving me the opportunity to speak here today. It's especially important for me as a PhD student, and I'm really grateful. The PowerPoint is only the outline of my presentation. No romantic images, I'm afraid. I'm sorry, this is a disappointment. Right. At the end of the First World War, Bell had been part of the British military intelligence staff in Basra for about 2 years. During that period, in difficult conditions, she worked to provide valuable information about the tribes of the region to the British authorities over there. And she seems to have been aware at the time that she was taking part in something which was an important undertaking. Now, this thought was exciting for Gertrude, but at the same time, she was a bit anxious as she wondered about the result of the enterprise. Now, even if she did not know exactly what the outcome of her endeavors would be, she had at that time a strong opinion about the future of the country from a political point of view, and she was then quite certain that the inhabitants of Mesopotamia were not yet ready to govern themselves. And so, in fact, she favored direct rule under the authority of Percy Cox, who was then a civil commissioner. Now, after the 1919 Paris Peace Conference and throughout the year 1919, Bell changed her mind, and gradually she became an ardent supporter of the idea of having a Hashemite solution for the soon-to-be Kingdom of Iraq. Now, Faisal, Hussein's she had met in Paris during the conference was her ideal candidate. And so therefore, in 1919, Bell became known as a Sharifian. Now, there are a few well-known political reasons which account for this change of mind. Of course, Bell realized that Arab nationalism, even though maybe not yet very coherent, was nevertheless gaining momentum, and that therefore the British needed to make the most of this development instead of fighting against it. And later on, of course, in 1920, with the Iraqi revolt, of course, this event stressed even more the urgent need to find a form of a solution and a form of indirect rule for the country, thus strengthening Gertrude's beliefs in the Hashemite solution. Now, I think it's also necessary to investigate this transition in Bell's thinking against the backdrop of the cultural representations and mental images which shaped her vision of the Hashemites in general, and of course of Faisal in particular. So I would like to show that Faisal's appearance, personality, family background, and lineage all triggered romantic perceptions in Gertrude's mind, and these representations, I think, participated in converting her to the Hashemite solution, but also their account for Bell's support of Faisal after he was made king of Iraq, and I will try to show that her discourse evolved as the political events themselves evolved, of course. Now, I do not mean that such a political woman as Gertrude Bell was driven in her support of Faisal only by her romantic perceptions. So rather, I will try to show that representations and the political context were always closely intertwined. So in this first part, I would just like to try and give a brief account of the way Gertrude perceived the territory which the British called Arabia, in order to show that her vision of this territory constituted a specific cultural background which may have paved the way for her favorable perception of the Hashemites and of Faisal in particular. So first, I think that Gertrude Bell comes within this tradition of British agents who were involved in the transformation of the Middle East in the first half of the 20th century, and who made a clear-cut division between Arabia on the one hand and the Levant on the other hand. So, of course, the Levant being this region, this coastal region along the eastern Mediterranean, which those British agents often saw as a kind of Mediterranean melting pot subject to excessive European influence, whereas on the other hand, Arabia, the inland part, desert area of the Arabian Peninsula stretching to the Persian Gulf, which the British often saw as the heartland of a pure and much more authentic Arab identity. Now, unlike Sykes, for example, or even Lawrence, Bell did not show contempt towards the Levant and its inhabitants, but I think it's quite clear from her early, from the early letters which she wrote during her early travels to the region, that she did not like Levantine cities much. So clearly, the east which Bell longed for was clearly Arabia, the more desert part of it. So she did not feel very much at ease in the Levant, and she was puzzled by what she perceived as the absence of clear-cut national character in the Levant. So this melting pot puzzled Gertrude. On the other hand, she seems to have associated Arabia with the notion of purity. For example, on one of her desert excursions from Jerusalem in 1900, she arrived at a place called Del Kufain, and she describes it saying that it was, I quote, much more Arcadian than Arcadia. Arcadia being this region described in Greek poetry as a kind of paradise. And what she liked about the place was the fact that it was secluded and impervious to outside influence. Now, of course, Gertrude Bell was fascinated by Arabia because of the tribes and of the Bedouins living in this territory. And on one of her desert journeys, she met the Adwan Bedouins, and she says about them that they are, I quote, the Arabs par excellence. So as she saw it, Bedouins embodied the very essence of Arab identity. And then, of course, she's very charmed by the personality of the great tribesmen whom she met during her journeys, like, for example, the chief of the Druzes, whom she met in 1900, Yahya Beg, and she says, he's the most perfect type of the grand seigneur, a great big man, very handsome, and with the most exquisite manners. So, of course, this leads me to the romance of the East. Apart from its authenticity, Goethe's interest for the region was triggered, well, by its historical and archaeological features, of course, but also simply because it was a romantic and an exotic place where adventures were likely to happen. And even during her stay in Ha'il, which was unpleasant because she was virtually held prisoner in the absence of Ibn Rashid, well, even there she was able to enjoy the beauty and what she calls the romance of the setting, which was reminiscent of what she calls medieval Asia. And she even compared the tricky situation she was in to a plot in one of the Arabian Nights stories. So I think that Arabia was a place which was romantically perceived by many British agents, including Bell. And I think as the Hashemites were from that region, and more particularly from the Hejaz, the birthplace of Islam, and as they were descended from the Prophet, I think they were likely to be perceived by the British as natural Arab gentlemen fit to rule. So I think this constituted the cultural background to Bale's later relationship with Faisal. So now I'd like to dwell with Bale's relationship with Faisal once he was made king of Iraq. So first, Bale's idealization of Faisal's personality. Before Faisal's so-called election, Bale accompanied him often, and she was very glad to see that his inspiring personality brought him the support of key personalities in the country. Bale saw Faisal as the ideal ruler for Iraq because he was, in her eyes, a great Sunni and a great tribesman. For example, in July 1921, she organized a meeting with the Tulaim tribe with Faisal. I quote, "He, Faisal, was supremely happy, a great tribesman among famous tribes, and as I couldn't help feeling, a great Sunni among Sunnis. Faisal was in his own country with the people he knew. The people at the end of the tent were too far off to hear, so he called them all up, and they sat on the ground below the dais, rows and rows of them, 400 or 500 men. He spoke in the great tongue of the desert, sonorous, magnificent, no language like it. He spoke as a tribal chief to his feudatories." And then she went on to describe the moment as unique because Faisal had been placed in his natural environment thanks to the British. And she called Faisal, I quote, "the finest living representative of his race." Now, here, of course, Gertrude enjoyed finding again the atmosphere of tribal life, which fascinated her, with the close proximity between the speaker and his audience. Now, on top of being an eminent representative of Sunni Islam and of tribal identity, Faisal, said Gertrude, was also an enlightened man from a religious point of view, and she was very glad to say that he made a very gracious speech in front of the Jewish community of Iraq, and that they were reassured as they had been somewhat worried about the establishment of an Arab government. So really, Faisal has all the qualities, according to Bale. And I'd like to emphasize this phrase which he uses, his own people. So sometimes she uses the phrase to mean tribesmen as above, and sometimes she means the Arab people in general, and more particularly the Arab people of the 7th century. For example, still during the so-called election, she took Faisal on a trip to Ctesiphon, and she set out to tell Faisal the story of the Arab conquest of the country as it had been recorded by Tabari, the early Muslim scholar. And so, once again, she says, this was the tale of his own people, thus establishing a direct link, right, between the Arabs of the 7th century and Faisal in 1921. A few months afterwards, the Muharram celebrations inspired Gertrude even more. And so she wrote to her father explaining him what Muharram was about, and she says that the parallel was perfect with Faisal's personal history. So I quote briefly. "Incidentally, when Faisal came, that story of his ancestor was in my mind. The parallel was so complete, the invitation from Iraq, the journey from Mecca, the arrival with nothing but his formal following. If the end has proved different, it's because I said exit omen so often. So thanks to Gertrude's prayers, Faisal did not meet the same fate as his forefather." So it seems that Gertrude was blind to the obvious fact that the British were trying to impose a virtual stranger on the inhabitants of the country, mesmerized as she was by Faisal's lineage, which she thought made him legitimate to rule the country. So for her, clearly, this family background of his fitted perfectly into Iraqi history and into a larger Arab history. Now, of course, I'm very late. Belle valued her relationship with Faisal because she saw it as an intimate relationship. So she often used the pronoun we when she reported her conversation with Faisal. And she said, for example, "The king told me about his family history, and we discussed what his mother and his grandmother were, and what his daughters were like, and we discussed whom his daughters should marry and how we would educate his son." So there is this close proximity, and in fact it was very mind-boggling for Gertrude to have such an influence on the king, as she thought having influence on Faisal meant having influence on the whole destinies of the Arab world, as she said herself. I also wanted to show in this part that Gertrude Bell became, she quickly set out to take care of Faisal's, let's say, public relations. So she encouraged him to meet important people, she encouraged him to use, I quote, his personality more. So she guided him during society events, especially as Bell was one, she was in fact the only British woman speaking Arabic. And Faisal did not speak English, so Bell was always accompanying him during social events to translate for him. I think I need to move on. So now, in the last part, I wanted to show the evolution of Bell's discourse once the political context between the British and Faisal started to deteriorate over the question of the treaty, notably. So I don't have time to recall the political context, but I will just say that at first, Bell was rather understanding with the situation in which Faisal was. So she understood that he needed to be a credible figure to the nationalists. But then as the crisis intensified, and as Faisal tacitly encouraged the opposition to the mandate, Bell's perception of Faisal, of course, changed, and she was disappointed by his attitude. So she described him as being a malleable ruler, too easily swayed by the influence of the nationalists. And what's interesting, I think, is that even when she tried to confront him, she never succeeds in turning her back on him completely, because then, for Bell, Faisal's defects are typically Oriental. That's what she said herself. "He's naturally fine and discriminating, but he has the fatal defects of the Oriental, lack of moral courage and lack of intellectual pose." So Bell went on criticizing Faisal's political strategies. Of course, there's the issue of nationalism. There's many other sources of tension between the British and Faisal. And I just want to say that even in moments of very strong political disagreement, she was still very fond of the king. And I think Faisal was far from being the passive object of her representations. I think he was very much aware of the effect that he had on Gertrude, and he played with it, especially in moments of crisis and tensions. Bell said that Faisal was unable and not mature enough to be up to prove equal to his fine ideals. Now, she never clearly defines what Faisal's ideals were, but of course one suspects that it was in fact her own ideals that he was not able nature, of course, of the discourse about Faisal, and not just on the part of Bell, in fact. He was idealized as the embodiment of Arab gentlemanliness, but as he proved more determined and less pliable than the British expected, they were quick to attribute his failings to his race. And I think the British denied him the possibility of having a vision for Iraq or a political strategy. Each time he tried to implement something, whether it was a good or a bad strategy, but it was always called by the British scheming, plotting, or intriguing. And he was constantly accused of being subservient to the nationalists. And to finish, of course, I just want to say that obviously those discourses tell us more about the British than they do about Faisal. So I very much agree to what was said this morning. And I think the notion of projection is tremendously important to understand this. Thank you.
Charles Tripp talked about the dual state, a modern state and a shadow state. And I can compare the role of Cox and Bell to the modern state and the shadow state. Because in my PhD, I did not emphasize the role Bell played in deciding the future of Southern Kurdistan. It was my mistake. I'm trying to readdress that. For this opportunity, I divide my presentation into a period. Pre-Cairo conference, Cairo conference, and post-Cairo conference. In the first period, from the end of the First World War to 1920, there was a debate, great debate among the British officials working on the ground about the future of Kurdistan. Traditional colonial, or those who belong to the India school, wanted direct rule in southern Kurdistan. There was another school represented by Major Edward Nau, who thought the best way to consolidate British interest is to foster Kurdish political aspiration. And he did succeed in persuading London to establish the first Kurdish government or the first Kurdish entity, which extended from the Persian-Turkish frontier to the east, and the lesser Zab River to the west. And this Kurdish government lasted a few months. And then the forces of colonialism put an end to this experiment. At that time, Bell did not have any view. She was happy to see the downfall of the Kurdish government. The reason the Kurdish government was established was that Kurdistan, or southern Kurdistan, was the only place in modern Iraq which was not militarily occupied by the British. It was the Kurds who took the initiative to liberate their towns and their countryside. They invited the British to come to Soleimani Erbil Dag. As a result of that, the British were forced to set up a Kurdish government with the three political officers. One responsible for political affairs, the other for financial affairs, and the other one for military affairs. There was a Kurdish military unit, Kurdish judiciary system, and financial arrangements to run that entity. And it was successful. the main reason why the British put an end to that experiment was its success. Tribal leaders started to join from Kirkuk, Germiyan, even from Erbil. In a tribal society, like southern Kurdistan, the influence of Sheikh Mahmud exceeded all the notables of Iraq. At least half of the southern Kurds were loyal to him, and they accepted him as a leader. In the Arab Iraq, there was no single person who commanded this support. Nevertheless, Bel described him as a troublemaker, as no one. Sheikh Mahmud was the biggest landowner in Kurdistan. He was the head of the Sufi Qadiri order, which is the biggest order in Kurdistan. Tens of thousands of people were loyal to him. At the Cairo conference, after the destruction of the first government, soon two groups emerged. The first group, led by T.E. Lawrence, Hubert Young from the newly formed Near Eastern Department, and Edward Knoll and Churchill. This group believed that the best way to protect the new state, the new Arab state in Baghdad, is to allow the Kurds to decide their future. South of Kurdistan will perform the role of strategic shield to protect the Arab state from a Turkish invasion. The British were very worried about a possible Turkish invasion, even the extension of Bolshevism to Iraq. Second thing, they did not see a reason why they should ignore the political aspiration of the Southern Kurds. The other things, the Kurds could be used as a fighters to defend the Arab state in the north. Thus, they thought of a confederate relations between Southern Kurdistan and Baghdad. This is the best way to solve the issue of the future of Southern Kurdistan. The other group, led by Percy Cox and Bell, their views reflected an Arabist view. Knowing the support of the Sharifians was the cornerstone of their policy or their arguments. They thought Kurdistan, southern Kurdistan, should be immediately incorporated in Iraq into an Arab state Iraq. Please notice what they wanted in Iraq, not a state, not an Iraqi state. It wanted Arab state. There is a big difference. If you just examine her diaries, letters, she always talked about Arabism. Arab. So what she wanted in Iraq is an ethnically based state, a Sunni based state. And an Arab state, what I call it a three-dimensional state, Arab, Arabist, and Sunni. She argued that economically that Kurdistan depends on Mosul, which was not true. So only some district near to Mosul had commercial relations with Mosul. The rest of the Kurdish area had commercial relations to the north, to Diyarbakir, or to Kurdish towns across the border. Another argument that they used, that if we give the southern Kurds an entity, this will encourage other Arabs in the south to demand the same thing. At the end of the conference, it was decided southern Kurdistan will be excluded from the Arab state. I repeat this, because the official Iraqi interpretation of history never mentioned first government, Kurdish government, not the second Kurdish government, nor the result of the Cairo conference. Four in favor of a separate southern Kurdistan, only two were against it, Bell and Cox. And that is important things. Bell and Cox took with them Ja'far al-Askari. Ja'far al-Askari, at that time, he founded the Iraqi army. And Churchill saw this, and he said, I'm not going to place, I'm not going to allow an Arab army under an Arab government to oppress Southern Kurds. When he saw Ja'far, because Ja'far was the Minister of Defense, and that is extremely important, because in the future, we have an alliance between RAF, the Royal Air Force, and the Arab army to suppress Kurdish revolts in the 20s, 30s, 40s. So the result was in favor of separate Kurdistan in both Cairo Conference period. Bell and Cox spent most of their time and energy to persuade London that the Southern Kurds wanted incorporation. No autonomy, nothing. The referendum of 1920, please read it carefully. You will find out that all the Kurds who participated in the referendum wanted a Kurdish independent state. The Kurds of Kirkuk, 100% voted, according to British record, for a Kurdish state. Sulaymaniyah province boycotted the referendum. We have the district now part of the province of Erbil and Duhok. Then, approval of Faisal was on one condition, if there is no Kurdish state. This proved that the Southern Kurds did not want to be part of Iraq, even though it was a sham referendum. And it's very strange to know that he got 98% next to Saddam Hussein. It's only Saddam Hussein got 99% of the vote of the population. It took Saddam Hussein 30 years to produce 99. It took Bell and Cox only one day today to get 98% of the votes. Why Bell was so hostile towards the establishment of a separate Southern Kurdistan? The first factor is the Sharifian factor. In my view, she was pan-Arabist in the way she embraced their ideas. The Sharifia from the 1915-1916 demanded the inclusion of Southern Kurdistan into the Arab state. If you go and read the exchange of letters between MacMahon and Sharif Hussein, there is a demand from Sharif Hussein that the Kurdish area south of the Arbakir up to the area near Mendeley al-Khat should be included in the Arab state for historical sentimental reason. For Bell, it was very important to support the demand of the Baghdadi officer and Faisal. They demanded that Southern Kurdistan must be part of Iraq. They call it Mosul. It's not really Mosul. Mosul is just a town. I'm talking of the vast majority of the land. It's Kurdish land and populated by the Kurds. And the second factor, which is economic. She thought Kurdistan is a economically weak and it will depend on the Arab state. And again, that wasn't true. All British financial burden, military burden was in the central and southern part of Iraq, not in Kurdistan. Kurdistan, as an entity, was viable economically because it didn't cost the British anything. military units, there were Christian military units to protect that region. The other factor is strategic, that we cannot trust the Kurds. Maybe they will side with the Turks. So extremely important to cooperate Southern Kurdistan, to function as a natural zone of shield to protect the Arab state. And the other factor is the Christian factor. Kurdistan is a home of a Christian community. And many Christians left from Hakkari to the north of the northern border of Iraq. From Hakkari, there was a revolt during the First World War. They sided, the Christian, the Artorian community sided with the Russians, revolted against Turkish rule. The Kurds sided with the Turks because they are Muslim. And the Christian fled and went to Oromia in Persia. Then they left Oromia to Baquba, to the north of Baghdad, when the Bolshevik Revolution broke out and the Russian army withdrew from Oromia. So they have a problem, a moral problem. These people sided with the British, with the Russians, against the Turks. Where to settle these people? How to secure their future? They were sent directly to Kurdistan. So if Mosul go back to Turkey, it means this Christian will leave. They are facing another problem. So the Christian factor was another factor which persuaded Bell, Cox, and others. It's the best way is to incorporate Southern Kurdistan into Iraq. And Bell gives the Kurds two options, either immediate incorporation or gradual incorporation. And that gradual incorporation was applied to Soleimania. Soleimania was and is the center of Kurdish nationalism. And thank you for listening.
Well, I think you'll all agree we've had three fascinating presentations. The first was perhaps a somewhat surreal election and coronation. And the second, we had a presentation of the fascination of Gertrude Bell with the noble Arab as epitomized by King Faisal. And I thought it was rather ironic hearing Dr. Saad Iskander's presentation to think that the first occupation by the British resulted in the suppression of Kurdish aspirations, whereas the second one gave the encouragement to them. I throw the floor open now to questions. The first one, I think, is over there.
Nelida Fukara from SOAS. Can you hear me? Well, thank you very much. I mean, this is a comment and a question for Mariam's, but also a comment to that speaks to Iskander side presentation. I mean, I think, Mariam, what you have actually emphasized at the beginning of your talk is something very important, is the role of Gertrude Bell as intelligence officer. And it is indeed in the field of intelligence that this whole idea of Arabia as a terrain of colonial imagination and practice was formed, not only in 1919, but indeed throughout the First World War and even before, and Priya Satya has written about it in a very good way. So, and as a matter of fact, this idea of Arabia, I think, was not just a geographical idea. It wasn't the Arabian Peninsula as we know it today or Saudi Arabia, but it was the idea of the desert. Now, so to me, intelligence is a very important operational context within which we have to understand views of certain type of reality as they were formed in policy making. And in other words, it is through intelligence that certain categories of Iraqi society, tribes, Sharifians, desert dwellers, and so forth, were formed. So I'm wondering whether you could say a bit more about Gertrude Bell as an intelligent officer. And indeed, this idea of the creation of colonial imagination about Arabia and the ways in which it was reflected in the actual policymaking shows exactly the opposite in the case of the Kurds, because the Kurds did not become a subject of colonial imagination in the same way as the Arabs. They started being studied like that only after, you know, after 1918, 1919. And in that respect, actually, that's why probably Gertrude Bell was not that, obviously not that concerned with the Kurds. Thank you.
So this doesn't leave me much time to to think about the answer. Priya Sacha's book is fascinating in that respect, as far as, well, yes, the colonial imagination is concerned. Yes, I think indeed this imagination is rather old. As you said, it started even before the First World War. And I think Bell and also the others were very much inspired, among others, by Doughty and his Arabia Deserta. And they all traveled in the region with their Doughty, you know, trying to follow his path. Now, as to the question, as well as an intelligence officer, I guess it's sending us to what was discussed this morning as to whether or not she was really, at least during the First World War, is if her opinion and her travel writings were closely read, and whether or not they had a direct impact on policy making before the First World War. Honestly, I don't know. Now, afterwards, when she was in Iraq, I think her imagination had and her representations did have an impact on policy making, especially at the beginning of the mandate, because she was so close to Cox, who really listened to her. Well, perhaps I should qualify this, because on the other hand, she did not, well, she had an informal role, so it's always difficult, I think, with Bell to say whether or not she had such a direct impact. But she discusses everything with Faisal, even though in an informal way. And in her letters, she's always very careful to say, "I'm reporting this, but I'm having no formal role in this." But in fact, she knows everything about it, and she has clearly strong opinions. So I think she really was influential.
I think Tamara is.
It's a question to Dr. Saad, actually two questions. I was just wondering, you mentioned the first camp of people in Cairo, Lawrence, etc. And from what I recall, he actually was supporting a different kind of, a different configuration of Al Jazeera, which was a totally different country. So I was wondering if you could say something about that in the context of the Kurds. And then the second question about the reasons why, the reasons you listed at the end of why the British felt strongly, or Cox and Bell felt strongly about having southern Kurdistan as part of the modern state. I mean, well, what about the link between, or rather the fact that, you know, the Mosul province as a large, I mean, historic Ottoman province, which included most of southern Kurdistan, was initially promised to the French with the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And then, as we know very well, even after the creation of the state of Iraq, Mosul continued to be, you know, negotiated with the Turks until 1925, when Lord Curzon kind of sealed the deal. So it wasn't something that was conclusive, in fact, with their input, so to speak.
As for T. Lawrence, I was surprised to see him as an idealist. He was a true representative of this Cairo school. He did not want the Kurds to be under Arab rule. I was surprised when I read his intervention in Cairo conference and show you that these people were honest in many ways. In the principle, they believed it's not just for the propaganda. They were not just agents of imperialism. This is one. Second, about the issue of the future of Mosul. If you look at the Sykes-Picot map, most scholars make mistakes. They don't make distinctions between Mosul as a town, Mosul as a province. In my PhD, I mentioned that many scholars, like the journalist who wrote a book about the Kurds, David, I forgot his name, David McDowell. He didn't make a distinction between. In fact, oil, Kirkuk was in the British spheres of influence, not the French. He thought it was in the French spheres of influence. In the Iraq literature, they talk about Mosul, not southern Kurdistan. If you go to British documents, they use the word southern Kurdistan, southern Kurds. It's not invented by me. It was, the concept was used at the Cairo conference and even before the Cairo conference. I didn't have enough time to experiment. The sectarian reason, the Kurds, most of them were Sunnis, and the Sunni Arabs were a minority in the Arab state, so they needed to readdress this balance between Sunnis and Shiites. This is another reason why Kurdistan was incorporated into Iraq. Bell and Cox failed after the referendum of 1921. They were forced to bring Sheikh Mahmud from India, from exile, and give him another chance to set up a new Kurdish government. As soon as he arrived to Sulaymaniyah, most of the Kurdish tribes declared their loyalty to him, including the Talabani, the famous Talabani clan or religious order. So his influence extended from almost to Dohuk, to the west, to the Persian Turkish, the old Persian Turkish frontier. That was the reason why he was brought down and suppressed by force. And Bell, in her diaries, welcomed the bombing of civilian Kurdish villages. It was very strange that lady, the educated lady, to support such action against civilians. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Eric Avery, Vice Chair of the Parliamentary Human Rights Group, and my great-grandmother was first cousin to Gertrude Bell. I'm ashamed of Gertrude Bell's attitude to Kurdish self-determination. And I'm just wondering, I mean, the Wilson principles had been enunciated. They had seemingly no effect on British thinking as regards the disposal of the South Kurdistan. But supposing things had turned out differently, supposing Cox and Bell had applied the principle of self-determination to Kurdish aspirations, why would they have stopped at South Kurdistan? Should they not have, in accordance with Wilson's principles, have thought about the creation of a Kurdish entity, which would have included, obviously, the vilayet of Diyarbakir as well as Mosul? Did that never come into the equation at all?
You mean the establishment of a Kurdish state?
I think you mean including part of Turkey. Yeah. That not come into the equation.
First, I have to go back to the what's in 14 points. It was for the white race, not for the Eastern race. A lot of people, even Kurdish nationalists, Arab nationalists, did not realize his 14 points, the point about self-determination, will apply to Europe. The emergence of several modern states in Europe, it was not applied in the Middle East. This one. The second is the first treaty, the peace treaty of Sewa. I don't know how to
say
treaty. It's our article included establishment of a Kurdish state, a small Kurdish state at the heart of Kurdistan. About 80% of Kurdistan was excluded from that Kurdish state. And it was thought that in later stage, they will decide their future. everybody knows that the treaty was not ratified, and the rise of the Turkish nationalism under Mustafa Kemal was the main reason why the Sevilla Treaty was not translated into reality. The Americans withdrew from the idea of establishing an Armenian state to the north of Kurdistan. There were several factors. The Bolsheviks came as a new force, and they were, Churchill and others were afraid that the Bolsheviks will ally themselves with the Turkish nationalism, and they will consider a threat to British interests and British presence in Mesopotamia and southern Kurdistan. So it was, in my view, a strategic reason which forced the British to repartition Kurdistan after the first war. It's not oil, it's not anything else. It's mainly strategical, as well as the newborn child, which is called Iraq.
Thank you. Want to add to that?
I'm Richard Long. I would rather have made this observation this morning, but it's still relevant, I think. In assessing the importance of Gertrude Bell in the foundation of modern Iraq, one obviously needs to consider the roles of other British political actors in the process. Toby Dodge's talk this morning I thought was extremely interesting in that he brought in people I wouldn't have counted among their number, particularly Longrig. But I would contend that more important than some of the people we've mentioned is Arnold Wilson. Arnold Wilson as acting political officer made three contributions to the drawing up of the framework of Iraq. First of all, he got the Imperial Army, led by General Marshall, to take Mosul province before the end of the First World War, just as the armistice was coming down. He said, go and take it before the whistle blows. And indeed, the army took it after the whistle had blown. Secondly, Cox, whom he had replaced on an acting basis, had been told to administer the Baghdad province and the Basra province differently. Basra was to be independent, Baghdad to be British controlled. And Arnold Wilson said, this is nonsense. I will have nothing to do with it. Told London so, and that idea was never heard of again. Thirdly, when Faisal was thrown out of Syria by the French, Arnold Wilson said, let's have Faisal for Iraq. I consider that these three claims of actions by Arnold Wilson are ones that we shouldn't forget. But here, as elsewhere, he always seems to be the forgotten man. Does it need to continue like that?
Well, okay. I tried to answer your question to start with the third one. Arnold Wilson, I certainly mentioned him, gave him much weight in my presentation, which could not be set due to the short of time. But I don't know exactly how to check your first point. I think Mosul was taken by the British forces after the ceasefire. Is this correct? So this was a violation of the ceasefire, right? Let's not forget. So, talking about British activities and so on. Sorry, help me. What was your third point? Well, this was disputed, of course. I mean, classical or in Arab history, Iraq was. Will I get Baghdad? Will I get Basra? And Mosul was added. And when we go to Sykes-Picot, this area was supposed to be part of the French area of influence, right? But later it became part of Iraq and so on. I mean, this was a lot of dispute going on, right, at the time, and until it was finally settled. Excuse me, may I ask you, what was the third point? Yeah, but Gertrude Bell in a letter claims that it was Wilson who brought up this idea. Whether this is authentic, I mean, one has to see it in the whole context. I give Gertrude Bell in her personal letters a lot of credibility. But again, Gertrude Bell was not sure from the very beginning. And when you read her Persian letters, she says the Arabs is like a big child. They cannot rule themselves and this kind of stuff. And then at a certain point, I try to elaborate this in my paper. At a certain point, she changed her mind. I'm not sure whether one can fix a certain day or a minute. What time is now? Gertrude Bell changed her mind. But she changed her mind in many aspects. What is the word? Adapted to the change situation.
Thank you. Just bringing Dr. Miriam.
Yeah, just about, precisely about the third point about Wilson agreeing to consider Faisal as a solution for Iraq. This was a long transition in his thinking. First, of course, he thought that the British should either rule Iraq directly or leave altogether. And then it was because the people in London impressed upon him that those days were over and that there was a need for a form of indirect rule. And so towards the end, indeed, he said, well, okay, if we must have indirect rule, then Faisal would be my choice. But it was not a spontaneous choice. I would say Tim Paris has shown this.
The idea of occupying Mosul Greek just before the end of the war, it wasn't Arnold Wilson's decision. It was already made in London. That's extremely important to occupy the town. If you don't occupy the center of the wilayat, the case of the Turks to take back Mosul be stronger, because Mosul was the center of the wilayah, of the province. That's the reason why the British army advanced from Kirkuk very quickly to occupy Mosul 1 week before the armistice. That's it.
Edward Chaplin.
Thank you.
I'm afraid the last question.
Oh, right. I'll make it brief then. Edward Chaplin, PC Council member, former ambassador to Iraq and also to another Hashemite kingdom of Jordan at an earlier stage. Just to get away from Kurdistan for a moment, I mean, what a missed opportunity. I mean, if we'd given Kurdistan independence, it'd save ourselves not a lot of trouble later on. But my question was actually about Gertrude Bell and to Miriam Yacoubi mainly. I wonder whether her clearly very romantic view of Arabia versus the Levant wasn't also coloured by her extreme hostility to the French. I mean, most British diplomats are pretty rude about the French from time to time, but, I mean, hers is in a different category, and it comes out very clearly in her letters, I think, that she regarded the French as working very energetically against everything the British were trying to do in the Middle East. Of course, there was the ejection of Faisal from Syria behind that. But I wonder whether her view of the qualities of Arabia and of Faisal were not partly driven by political and strategic considerations, not just by romantic ones. Thank you.
I would qualify Gertrude's hostility towards the French. In fact, when she was working in the Arab Bureau, she wrote a letter to Robert Cecil saying that, in her opinion, the British should not take the risk of jeopardizing their relationship with the French over Syria for Hussein's ambitions. So she was aware of this need to compromise with the French. Later on, once Faisal was ousted from Syria, she says, well, now the only way, the only thing standing in our way to put Faisal in Iraq is the French. And then she says, damn the French. And that's not my expression. It's really the words she uses. So she changed her mind there too, I think. First she wanted to accommodate the French, and then she thinks that it's worth, Faisal is worth, entering into conflict with the French. She wasn't as hostile to the French as Lawrence or Sykes were, I think. In Sykes' pre-war writings, it's rather obvious that he's hostile to the Levant because the elites there are Francophile and French-speaking, and clearly he does not feel at home there as a British.
Thank you. I think we have reached it. You're correct.
Excuse me for succeeded. Wolfgang Koehler mentioned this really rather surreal image that the platform on which Faisal was enthroned was made out of old beer crates with the word Nafi still stenciled on them. Now, in one sense, this is banal, this is just an anecdote, but perhaps it is an apt symbol in one particular way. At least I would suggest this, that if you think back at the brief period of time between the Cairo conference and the coronation of Faisal, the whole thing was cobbled together, wasn't it? In an incredibly short time, Faisal comes to Iraq, arrives in Iraq, the referendum, the phony referendum, the coronation, and then the formation of the first government. I'm tempted to say the making of the modern Iraqi state, whatever we think about it, whatever our judgment on it, was a quite remarkable piece of improvisation.
Can I say something? Yes. Even before the Cairo conference, year before, Bell worked very hard to what I call it Sharifization of Iraqi administration. She put in certain position within the administration Sharifians pro Faisal. For example, the Iraqi army was established before the establishment of the Iraqi state. The first council was formed before the establishment of the Iraqi state, Council of Ministers. And all the ministers, most of them were either loyal to Faisal and the Sharifian cause, or they did not mind the imposition of someone from abroad to be the king of Iraq. So it wasn't that sudden. She paved the way. If you read her diary in 1919 and 1920, it's all about Faisal and the Sharifian and the Baghdadi officers. She created the political class. She imported this political class. So it wasn't improvisation. It was well planned by her. Thank you.
Thank you for your observation. I would fully agree. It was a big act of improvisation. When you read Bell's letters, you get the impression that these officials, British officials, on the spot, and also in kind of exchanges with London, Whitehall, they spend a lot of time and intellectual energy to discuss how to put Faisal on the throne properly, should I say properly, by election. When election was difficult because you need electoral lists and this kind of things. You couldn't go back to Ottoman times, or plebiscite, and I can't remember what was the third option. But this was discussed apparently on a daily basis by people who never considered the election of their head of state. But to establish, to create, if you like, this new state, this had to be done properly. To please whom? To please the League of Nations, to please the French. At one point, Ghetto says this or that solution would square the French. And I'm aware of what you're quoting at one point when she said, damn the French, this kind of things. I'm not in a position to say who was more anti-French, Bell or Lawrence.
So just quickly, I think the beer crates for the days, it's really emblematic of the artificiality and fragility of the state and the kingdom they were creating. And about whether or not this was an improvised thing, in the proceedings of the Cairo conference, you can read that they only count on Faisal's personality. His personality is going to sweep away all opposition. It's going to be natural and there's nothing to do because, you know, it's going to be very easy. So that's what they say. But in fact, I agree that they carefully paved the way for him. There's the exile, or the kidnapping, in fact, of Sayyid Talib. So they don't only count on Faisal's personality. They're really careful to get rid of any opposition before establishing him. Sayyid Talib of Basra. What happened is that, if I'm not mistaken, I speak under the authority of other people here, but what happened is that before Faisal came to Iraq, there were rumors that the British were going to have him come in the country to be the ruler of the country. And during a dinner, he said that if this happened, you know, there might be another trouble, uprising, so there might be trouble for the British again. So they didn't want to take the risk, and he was kidnapped and sent into exile.
That's one quick point. Right. If you look at the candidates for the throne of Iraq, all of them were quickly dismissed, Sheikh Azal, Sayyid Talib, and others. So all their efforts were focused on Faisal. So it was not improvised, it was well planned.
Mr. Hanush, is that
really a very quick comment? As somebody who actually comes from Mosul, I'm not quite sure. I'm glad that decision was made, you know, to actually take Mosul, because there was nothing Turkish about Mosul. I've seen the towns of Iskenderun and Alexandretta before, and I've seen the towns that have been taken up by Turkey, and I've seen the Syrian population, the Arab population there, and the way they've been treated. And to think that I would have been treated the same way, I don't know. So, in a way, I'm glad that the British took it. Thank you.
Yes, the lady at the back, the middle.
Sorry, I didn't say the town of Mosul is Kurdish.
No, I said Turkish.
Okay, sorry.
Hi. Yes, my name is Lisa Cooper. I'm from the University of British Columbia in Canada. And this question is directed to Miriam Yacoubi about this whole romantic notion of Arabia and this wanting to introduce a new Arab country, whether it might be motivated in part by her archaeological background as well. She was, after all, working up to 1914 quite intensively on work related to the Abbasid era, a palace that was occupied during that period, and would have become very well knowledgeable of the Abbasid era and the great age of the caliphs. And I'm wondering if that also factored into her romance, this possible idea of Faisal as bringing in this kind of new Arab unification. So again, very much colored by her background, her historical and archaeological background.
Yes, very briefly, yes, I agree. I think that indeed the historical and archaeological background and the knowledge of Bell in those areas, participated in shaping her romantic image of the region. And of course, Bell, but not only other British agents too, when they come to Baghdad, of course, they think about the Arabian Nights of Harun al-Rashid and so on and so forth. And also, of course, they think about the glorious pre-Islamic past of the area. And there are often comments about that. Now, they're often disappointed when they come to Baghdad. They're disappointed in comparison to what they have in mind and what they've read. But so, yes, I think, well, I tried to show briefly with Islamic history that for Bell, Faisal fitted into this much larger history, indeed.
There was one question there, yes.
Thank you. My name is, can you hear me? My name is Harvey Weiss, and I'm from Yale University. I wish to comment on Professor Dodge's paper and the significance of Colonel Wilson and some of the issues surrounding the drive for the mandate. The first point is that actually Colonel Wilson's fame really began prior to everything we've been discussing here, I believe, and that is when he was with his Indian troops in Khuzestan and first moved towards the village of Masjidi Suleiman, where he and his Indian soldiers were overwhelmed by the sulfurous fumes emanating from the dank pools behind the village, which turned out to be the first British in authority observation of the oil of Southwest Asia. This, however, had been preceded a decade earlier by Jacques de Morgan, the later excavator of Susa. But Jacques de Morgan's survey of the lands between the western face of the Zagros and the eastern bank of the Tigris, where de Morgan predicted there would be oil from Basra to Kirkuk. This was followed shortly thereafter by the foundation of the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, which today we know as British Petroleum. Colonel Wilson duly reported immediately to his chief, then the secretary or the chancellor of the Navy, I'm not sure what term is used in Britain for that, who happened to be Winston Churchill. And he reported to him in the following fashion. We've discovered this oil, it's right at the surface, and I think it will be very important for British investors. And secondly, I believe it will solve the problem of how to float our Navy. And thirdly, I believe it will solve this problem without any foreign policy issues, as in fact it is ours, and it will reduce our dependence upon foreign oil. And so I think this relates to the question that Professor Dodge raised earlier, and that is, in his paper, he observed that the British interest was in fact the extraction of wealth and its transfer to a new class. And that extraction of wealth, in his observation, was the irrigated wheat and barley of southern Iraq. However, the question that was not addressed in Professor Dodge's paper, I believe, is what was extracted on behalf of the British, who are investing so much into the creation of this mandate. That is, it is somewhat doubtful at this point that, in fact, it was being done in order to spread British democracy to West Asia. And so the great elephant in the room is, I believe, what were the British doing there in the first place? Thank you.
Thank you for that observation. I'm afraid we have run out of time. and it is perhaps a matter for you to perhaps talk privately with Toby Dodge. I'd like to thank the panel here for dealing so efficiently with your questions. We've swung this afternoon between idolization and demonization of Gertrude Bell with a touch of Eminence Grise in the middle, and I'm sure we shall carry on with this theme tomorrow. Thank you all very much.